his standard squarely in the center of the field, inviting the troops to rally around him rather than wander off in romantic cavalry charges at the periphery, assuring them by his example that if they could only hold the position he defined, they would again prevail. The manner in which the farewell address was actually composed, as it turned out, served as a nearly perfect illustration of its central message, the need to subordinate narrow interests to a larger cause. Much ink has been spilled by several generations of scholars in an effort to determine who wrote the bulk of the words that eventually found their way into print and then into the history books. Like a false scent, the authorship question has propelled historians down labyrinthine trails of evidence in quest of the real and true author. Meanwhile, the object of the hunt sits squarely in the middle of the evidentiary trail, so obvious that it is ignored. Namely, the creation of the farewell address was an inherently collaborative process. Some of the words were Madison's, most of the words were Hamilton's, all the ideas were Washington's. The drafting and editing of the farewell address, in effect, became a metaphor for the kind of collective effort Washington was urging on the American people as a whole. The story had its start 4 years earlier in May of 1792, when Washington approached Madison to help him compose a valedictory address. At the time, fully convinced that he would step down after one term, Washington had chosen Madison because his two most trusted cabinet members, Hamilton and Jefferson, were too closely associated with the party disputes he wanted to condemn. Madison made extensive notes on the basis of three conversations with Washington, then drafted a document that employed the president's own language for many key passages. A spirit of party in the government was becoming a fresh source of difficulty. We are all children of the same country. The nation's essential interests are the same. Its diversities arising from climate and from soil will naturally form a mutual relation of parts, and serve as the formulation for an affectionate and permanent union. It was Madison who first proposed that the farewell address not be delivered as a speech to Congress, but that it be printed in the newspapers as a direct address to the people who are your only constituents. After Washington listened to the unanimous advice of all his cabinet officers and reluctantly agreed to serve a second term, he tucked away Madison's draft for another day. That day arrived exactly 4 years later. On May 15, 1796, Washington sent Hamilton the first draft of a retirement address. No amount of persuasion could change his mind this time that would announce his departure from public life. The first section of this document reproduced Madison's draft of 1792, which was highly ironic because Madison had become the primary leader of the Republican opposition to Washington's policies in the Congress, and was therefore a rather dramatic example of the party spirit that his former words had warned against. The Federalists referred to Madison as the General of the Opposition, calling Jefferson his mentor, secluded at Monticello, the Generalissimo. Washington included the earlier Madison draft for two reasons. First, it expressed in clear and forceful language a major point he still wanted to make about subordinating sectional and ideological differences to larger national purposes, all the more resonant because drafted by someone who seemed to have forgotten the lesson. And second, its inclusion publicized the fact that he had wanted to retire 4 years ago, so his current decision was really the culmination of a long-standing preference. This latter point was extremely important to Washington. His most virulent critics were currently claiming that his support for the unpopular Jay's Treaty made him unelectable in 1796, so his decision to retire was not truly a voluntary act, but a forced recognition of the political realities. Hamilton tried to reassure him that his sensitivities on this score were excessive, that if he did choose to run for a third term, he would win in a walk, and Hamilton was surely correct. But Washington wanted not a shred of doubt to remain that his decision to step aside was wholly voluntary. This was both a matter of personal pride and a crucial political precedent. By including the Madison draft of 1792, he advertised his reluctance to serve even his second term, thereby enhancing the credibility of his voluntary rejection of a third. As Washington put it, "It may contribute to blunt, if it does not turn aside, some of the shafts among which conviction of fallen popularity and despair of being reelected, which will be leveled at me with dexterity and keenness." The second section of this first draft that Washington sent to Hamilton focused on the foreign policy issues that had dominated his second term. He was fully aware that Hamilton had supported Jay's treaty. He had even recommended that Hamilton consult Jay before putting pen to paper. But he also wanted Hamilton to know that none of his or Jay's pro-English prejudices should seep into his draft of the document. It should emphasize American neutrality and promote the true and permanent interests of the country. Washington's views, not Hamilton's, must prevail. Hamilton would be the draftsman, but Washington must be the author. "I am anxious always to compare the opinions of those in whom I confide with one another," Washington explained, "and these again without being bound by them with my own, that I may extract all the good I can." Hamilton required no elaborate instructions on the procedure. It was the same process Washington had developed with his staff as Commander-in-Chief of the Continental Army, then implemented with his cabinet as President. Hamilton had played the same role in both contexts. All major decisions were collective occasions in which advisers, like spokes on a wheel, made contributions, usually in written form. But in the end, the final decision, to include the final choice of words, came together at the center, which was always Washington. Hamilton also realized that he was being asked to write for posterity as much as the present. "It has been my object to render this act importantly and lastingly useful," he confided to Washington, "and avoid all just cause of present exception. To embrace such reflections and sentiments as will wear well, progress in approbation with time, and redound to future reputation." He devoted a full 2 months to revising Washington's draft, amplifying Madison's earlier account of the need to rise above party differences and rally behind the elected representatives of the national government. On July 30th, he sent the fruits of his labors to Washington, who found the Hamilton draft exceedingly just and just such as ought to be inculcated. His only reservation related to length. "All the columns of a large gazette would scarcely, I conceive, contain the present draft," Washington noted, adding at the end, "I may be mistaken." He was. Hamilton was less sure he had done the best job possible and immediately began work on a wholly new draft, which he submitted to Washington 2 weeks later, but Washington liked the earlier draft better. Over the next month, edited versions of that draft passed back and forth several times, with Washington pressing Hamilton for clarifications, deleting certain passages, adding others. "I shall expunge all that is marked in the paper as unimportant," he wrote on August 25th, "and as you perceive some marginal notes written with a pencil, I pray you to give the sentiments mature consideration." If Hamilton saw fit to make additional revisions on his own, he should let them be so clearly interlined, erased, or referred to in the margins that no mistake may happen. Washington wanted no last-minute changes smuggled in without his approval. Even when the final draft was ready for the printer in September, he made changes in 174 out of 1,086 lines in his own hand, and reviewed the punctuation throughout, a final scan, so the printer observed firsthand, in which he was very minute. It seems fair to conclude that what we call Washington's farewell address is not misnamed. What was Hamilton's contribution? Chiefly to assure that the elaboration of Washington's ideas occurred within a rhetorical framework that maintained a stately and dignified tone throughout, and to sustain a palpable cogency and sense of proportion in developing Washington's argument, which itself embodied the self-assurance so central to his major theme about the nation itself. Hamilton had nearly perfect pitch for Washington's language, having begun his public career drafting letters and memoranda for Washington's signature as a staff officer during the war. He was, therefore, well practiced in subordinating his own inclinations and style to Washington's larger purposes. In the farewell address, the result is nearly seamless. When combined with the collaborative character of the drafting process, it becomes virtually impossible to tell where one voice ends and another begins. But Hamilton was also such a virtuoso performer in his own right, unmatched within the revolutionary generation for his capacity to deliver powerful prose on a tight deadline, that there are moments in the farewell address when his own distinctive voice breaks through. For example, while Washington agreed with Hamilton's version of what the constitutional settlement of 1787 to 1788 meant, only Hamilton could have put it this way. "This government, the offspring of our own choice, uninfluenced and unawed, adopted upon full investigation and mature deliberation, completely free in its principles in the distribution of its powers, uniting security with energy, and containing within itself a provision for its own amendment, has a just claim to your confidence and support. The very idea of the power and right of the people to establish government presupposes the duty of every individual to obey the established government." Or, on the question of America's national interest and the foreign policy it dictated, again, the idea is pure Washington, but expressed in language that flowed in Hamiltonian cadences. "The great role of conduct for us in regard to foreign nations is in extending our commercial relations to have with them as little political connection as possible. Europe has a set of primary interests, which to us have none or a very remote relation. Hence, she must be engaged in frequent controversies, the causes of which are essentially foreign to our concerns. 'Tis our true policy to steer clear of permanent alliances with any portion of the foreign world. 'Tis folly for one nation to look for disinterested favors from another. There can be no greater error than to expect or calculate upon real favors from nation to nation. 'Tis an illusion which experience must cure, which a just pride ought to discard." When Hamilton showed a late draft of this passage to John Jay for his commentary, Jay expressed admiration for the style, but slight discomfort with the argument. "It occurs to me," he wrote to Washington, "that it may not be perfectly prudent to say that we can never expect favors from a nation, for that assertion seems to imply that nations always are or always ought to be moved only by interested motives." Jay's suggestion came too late. The farewell address was already in the hands of the printer, but would have made no difference. Washington meant exactly what Hamilton had said. Jay's views of prospective English beneficence, like Jefferson's views of French solidarity with America, were only seductive pieces of sentimentality, juvenile illusions in the real world of international relations. Beyond the tight cogency and felicitous cadences, Hamilton's major contribution was to save Washington from his own personal sentiments. In his May draft, Washington had included the following paragraph near the start. "I did not seek the office with which you have honored me, and now possess the gray hairs of a man who has, excepting the interval between the close of the Revolutionary War and the organization of the new government, either in a civil or military character, spent 45 years, all the prime of his life, in serving his country. May he be suffered to pass quietly to the grave, and that his errors, however numerous, if they are not criminal, may be consigned to the tomb of oblivion, as he himself will soon be to the mansion of retirement." Hamilton eliminated the references to gray hairs, prime of his life, and errors, however numerous. He also altered the wounded tone of the passage by placing it at the end rather than at the beginning of the farewell address, where it seemed less like a somewhat pathetic cri de coeur than a dignified personal testimonial. Washington recognized the improvement, congratulating Hamilton for rendering him with less egotism, meaning the Hamilton draft covered the wounds, or at least prevented the president from displaying them too conspicuously. Hamilton's exquisite sense of affinity for Washington's mentality failed him only once, though the failure, and therefore what is in effect the missing section of the farewell address, opens a more expansive window into the national vision that Washington was trying to project. During the drafting process in the summer of 1796, Washington kept urging Hamilton to insert a separate section on the creation of a national university in the capital city now being constructed on the Potomac. Hamilton resisted the recommendation, arguing quite plausibly that such a specific proposal was inappropriate for an address designed to operate at a higher altitude. It was, he suggested, the kind of proposal better made in the final message to Congress in the fall. But Washington kept insisting that he wanted the idea to be a featured element in the farewell address. "But to be candid," he explained, "I much question whether a recommendation of this measure to the legislature will have a better effect now than formerly. It may skew indeed my sense of its importance, and that it is a sufficient inducement with me to bring the matter before the public in some shape or another at the closing scenes of my political exit to set the people ruminating on the importance of the measure." Hamilton eventually relented, though only grudgingly. At the last moment, he inserted a brief two-sentence paragraph rather awkwardly near the middle of the farewell address, calling for institutions for the general diffusion of knowledge, and urging quite harmlessly that public opinion should be enlightened. Washington was not satisfied with the result, but decided to let the matter drop. In so doing, however, he let Hamilton know that something was being lost, that his hopes for a national university linked up to something larger. In the general juvenile period of life, when friendships are formed and habits established that will stick by one, he explained, the youth, or young men from different parts of the United States, would be assembled together and would by degrees discover that there was not just cause for those jealousies and prejudices which one part of the Union had imbibed against another part. What but the mixing of people from different parts of the United States during the war rubbed off these impressions? A century in the ordinary intercourse would not have accomplished what the 7 years' association in arms did. Here was a characteristically Washingtonian insight, rooted in his experience during the war years, simultaneously simple but essential, projecting developments into the future on the basis of patterns that were still congealing and that only now in retrospect seem so obvious. Like his misguided obsession with those Potomac canals, his campaign for a national university in the capital city never bore fruit. But both failed projects were also visionary projections linked to larger expectations. In the case of the National University, it was the recognition that the United States was still very much a nation in the making, because its population was still a people in the making. Time, indeed a considerable stretch of time, would be required to allow the bonding together of this large, widely dispersed, and diverse population. But institutions devoted to focusing the national purposes, again like the Continental Army during the war, could accelerate time and move America past that vulnerable and problematic phase of its development when fragmentation, perhaps civil war, was still a distinct possibility. Throughout the farewell address, Washington had been exhorting Americans to think of themselves as a collective unit with a common destiny. To our ears, it sounds so obvious because we occupy the future location that Washington envisioned. But his exhortations toward national unity were less descriptions than anticipations, less reminders of the way we were than predictions of what we could become. Indeed, the act of exhorting was designed to enhance the prospect by talking about it as if it were a foregone conclusion, which Washington most assuredly knew it was not. In the end, the farewell address was primarily a great prophecy, accompanied by advice about how to make it come true. It was also, at least implicitly, a justification for the strong executive leadership Washington had provided in the 1790s and that his critics had stigmatized as a monarchy. Without a Republican king at the start, he was saying, the new quasi-nation called the United States would never have enjoyed the opportunity to achieve its long-run destiny. It would have expired in the short run. In a sense, Washington was defending his presidency as an essential exception to full-blooded Republican principles. Down the road, when the common experience of conquering the continent and the sheer passage of time had bound the American people together into a more cohesive whole, the more voluntaristic habits at the core of Republican mentality could express themselves fully. For now, however, the center needed to hold. That meant a vigorous federal government with sufficient powers to coerce the citizenry to pay taxes and obey the laws. Veterans of the Continental Army, like Hamilton and John Marshall, fully understood this essential point. Intriguingly, the two chieftains of the Republican opposition, Jefferson and Madison, had never served in the Army. They obviously did not understand. How could this emerging nation manage its way through this first post-Washington phase of its development? In the farewell address, Washington offered his general answer. Think of yourself as a single nation. Subordinate your regional and political differences to your common identity as Americans. Regard the federal government that represents your collective interest as an ally rather than an enemy, as us, if you will, rather than them. In his eighth and final message to Congress, delivered the following December, Washington provided a more specific directive. His Republican critics had described Jay's treaty as a pact with the devil that was certain to produce domestic and diplomatic catastrophe. Upon scanning the horizon for the last time, however, Washington saw serenity setting in. Treaties with the hostile Indian tribes on the southern and western frontiers were being negotiated. The British were removing their troops from the posts in the west in accord with Jay's treaty. Thanks primarily to the resumption of trade with Great Britain, the American economy was humming along quite nicely, with revenues from the increased trade reducing the national debt faster than had been anticipated. The only dark spot on the political horizon was France, whose cruisers were intercepting American shipping in the West Indies. Washington counseled patience with what would soon be called this quasi-war with the French Republic, predicting correctly, as it turned out, that a spirit of justice, candor, and friendship will eventually ensure success. Confidence, he seemed to be saying, is a self-fulfilling prophecy, all the more so when the confidence was justified. Even more specifically, Washington suggested that his departure from the national scene would require the enlargement, not the diminution, of the powers of the federal government in order to compensate for his absence. He recommended that Congress undertake a whole new wave of federal initiatives, a new program to encourage domestic manufacturers, a similar program to subsidize agricultural improvements, the creation of a national university, his old hobby horse, and a national military academy, an expanded navy to protect American shipping in the Mediterranean and the Caribbean, increased compensation for federal officials in order to ensure that public service was not dependent on private wealth. It was the most expansive presidential program for enlarged federal power until John Quincy Adams proposed a similar vision in his inaugural address of 1825. It was the tradition that the Whig Party of Henry Clay and the Republican Party of Abraham Lincoln sustained in the 19th century, and that the Democratic Party of Andrew Jackson rejected. In the more immediate context of 1796, Washington seemed to be saying that the departure of America's only Republican king necessitated the creation of centering forces institutionalized at the federal level to maintain the focusing functions he had performed personally. Finally, who were these American people being bonded together? If Washington wished the national government to be regarded as us rather than them, how did he define the us? He addressed his remarks in the farewell address to his friends and fellow citizens. While he undoubtedly thought this description cast a wide and inclusive net that pulled in residents from all the regions or sections of the United States, it did not include all inhabitants. The core of the audience he saw in his mind's eye consisted of those adult white males who owned sufficient property to qualify for the vote. Strictly speaking, such men were the only citizens. He told Hamilton that his farewell address was aimed especially at the yeomanry of the country, which meant ordinary farmers working small plots of land and living in households. This brought women and children into the picture, not as full-blooded citizens, to be sure, but as part of the American people whose political identity was subsumed within the family and conveyed by the male heads of household. They were secondary citizens, but unquestionably Americans. Landless rural residents and impoverished city dwellers lay outside the picture, though they, more likely their descendants, could work their way into the American citizenry over time, if only potentially and prospectively they were included. The largest unmentioned and presumably excluded constituency was the black population, about 90% of which was enslaved. Washington said nothing whatsoever about slavery in his farewell address, sustaining the silence that the Congress had adopted as its official posture early in his presidency. Silence, of course, can speak volumes, and in Washington's case, the unspoken message was that a moratorium had been declared on this most controversial topic, which, more than any other issue, possessed the potential to destroy the fragile union that he saw as his life's work and chief political legacy. Since the primary purpose of the farewell address was to affirm that legacy and foster the promotion of his national vision, the last thing Washington wanted to mention was the one subject that presented the most palpable threat to the entire enterprise. Like Madison in 1790, he wanted slavery off the American political agenda. Unlike Madison, however, and unlike most of his fellow Virginians, there is a reason to believe that he thought the moratorium on slavery as a political problem should lapse in 1808, when the Constitution permitted the slave trade to end. His silence on the slavery question was strategic, believing, as he did, that slavery was a cancer on the body politic of America that could not at present be removed without killing the patient. The intriguing question is whether Washington could project an American future after slavery that included the African-American population as prospective members of the American citizenry. For almost all the leading members of the Virginia dynasty, the answer was clear and negative. Even those like Jefferson and Madison who looked forward to the eventual end of slavery also presumed that all freed blacks must be transported elsewhere. Washington never endorsed that conclusion. Nor did he ever embrace the racial arguments for black inferiority that Jefferson advanced in Notes on the State of Virginia. He tended to regard the condition of the black population as a product of nurture rather than nature. That is, he saw slavery as the culprit, preventing the development of diligence and responsibility that would emerge gradually and naturally after emancipation. By 1796, he had begun to draft his last will and testament, in which he eventually made elaborate provisions to assure that all his slaves would be freed upon the death of his wife. He also made even more elaborate provisions to guarantee that Mount Vernon would be sold off in pieces, part of the proceeds used to support his freed slaves and their children for several decades into the future. His action on this score, as usual, spoke louder than his words, for they suggested an obligation beyond the grave to assist his former slaves in the transition to freedom within the borders of the United States. Whether he could conjure up a vision of blacks and whites living together in harmony at some unspecified time in the future remains unclear. But he was truly rare within the political elite of Virginia in leaving this question open. He could and did imagine the inclusion of Native Americans. Late in August of 1796, at the same time he was making final revisions on his farewell address, Washington wrote his Address to the Cherokee Nation. From a strictly legal point of view, each of the various Indian tribes east of the Mississippi was already a nation, or an indigenous quasi-nation within the expanding borders of the United States. Therein, of course, lay the chief problem and the makings for an apparently inevitable tragedy. For in Washington's projection, the westward flow of the American population would prove relentless and unstoppable. "I also have thought much on this subject," Washington declared to the Cherokees, "and anxiously wished that the various Indian tribes, as well as their neighbors, the white people, might enjoy in abundance all the good things which make life comfortable and happy. I have considered how this could be done, and have discovered but one path that would lead them to that desirable solution. In this path, I wish all the Indian nations to walk." The one path Washington identified required the Indians to recognize that contesting the expansion of the white population was suicidal. The only realistic solution required the Indians to accept the inevitable, abandon their hunter-gatherer economies, which required huge tracts of land to work effectively, embrace farming as their preferred mode of life, and gradually, over several generations, allow themselves to be assimilated into the larger American nation. Washington acknowledged that he was asking a lot, that this path may seem a little difficult to enter, because it meant subduing their understandable urge to resist and sacrificing many of their most distinctive and cherished tribal values. As he prepared for his own retirement, In effect, he was encouraging the Indian tribes to retire from their way of life as Indians. "What I have recommended to you," he wrote somewhat plaintively, "I am myself going to do. After a few moons are past, I shall leave the great town and retire to my farm. There I shall attend to the means of increasing my cattle, sheep, and other useful animals." If the Indians would follow his example, the peaceful coexistence of Indians and whites could follow naturally, and their gradual merger into a single American people would occur within the arc of the next century. Whatever moral deficiencies and cultural condescensions a modern-day American audience might find in Washington's advice, two salient points are clear. First, it was in keeping with his relentless realism about the limited choices that history offered, and second, it projected Indians into the mix of peoples called Americans. Reactions to the farewell address fell into the familiar grooves. The overwhelming public response was tearfully exuberant, regretting the departure of America's political centerpiece for the last quarter century, but embracing his message, as one member of the cabinet put it, as a transcript of the general expression of the people of the United States. Meanwhile, the Republican press denounced his warnings against political divisions at home and diplomatic involvement abroad as the loathings of a sick mind. In the Aurora, Benjamin Franklin Bache reprinted the old charge that Washington had been a traitor who conspired with the English government during the war. "This man has a celebrity in a certain way," Washington remarked concerning Bache, "for his calumnies are to be exceeded only by his impudence, and both stand unrivaled." One of his last acts as president was to place on file in the State Department his rejoinder to Bache's accusations, which historians have long since discovered were based on forged English documents. He left office in March of 1797 with the resounding cheers of his huge army of supporters and the howls of that much smaller pack of critics echoing in his ears. Passing through Alexandria on his way to Mount Vernon, he stopped to deliver a speech in which he reiterated his allegiance to the principles articulated in the farewell address. "Clouds may, and doubtless often will, in the vicissitudes of events, hover over our political concerns," he announced, "but a steady adherence to these principles will not only dispel, but render our prospects the brighter by such temporary obscurities." He remained supremely confident that he was right to the very end, though the temporary obscurities being spewed out by the Republican press — France was America's international ally and the national government its domestic enemy — produced fits of private despair and periodic flare-ups of the famous Washington temper. Even ensconced under his vine and fig tree in retirement, he continued to subscribe to 10 newspapers. More than any great leader in American history before or since, he was accustomed to getting his way and equally accustomed to having history prove him right. But his final 2.5 years at Mount Vernon were beclouded by the incessant apprehension that his final advice to the country would be ignored, and his legacy, and with it his own place in history, abandoned. Part of his problem was a function of location. Mount Vernon, of course, lay within the borders of Virginia, and Virginia had become the homeland of the Republican opposition, which was dedicated to overturning the foreign policy and the entire edifice of national sovereignty that Washington stood for. In effect, Mount Vernon became an enclave within enemy territory, surrounded by neighbors committed to a Virginia writ large version of the American Republic. Washington, once the supreme Virginian, had in their eyes gone over to the other side. Once the all-purpose solution, Washington was now the still, potent problem, a kind of Trojan horse planted squarely in the Virginia fortress. The fact that he devoted so much of his remaining time and energy to overseeing the construction of the new capital city on the Potomac, it was a foregone conclusion that it would be named after him, only confirmed their worst fears, for that city, and the name it was destined to carry, symbolized the conspiracy that threatened, so Jefferson and his followers thought, all that Virginia stood for. Washington, for his part, obliged his Virginia critics by urging his step-grandson to attend Harvard in order to escape the provincial versions of learning currently ascendant in the Old Dominion. Increasingly, he seemed to think of his home state in the same vein as the Indian tribes in his letter to the Cherokees. The destiny of the American nation was pointing one way, and if the tribal chieftains of Virginia chose to oppose that direction, so be it, but they were aligning themselves on the wrong side of history. The end came on December 14, 1799. The previous day, when it became clear that the combination of pneumonia and the bleeding and blistering remedies of his physicians could produce but one conclusion, Washington ordered the doctors to cease their barbarisms and permit him to die in peace. "I am just going," he apprised those around his bed. "Have me decently buried, and do not let my body be put into the vault in less than 3 days after I am dead. Do you understand me?" Though he had no illusions of his own immortality, he apparently feared being buried alive, perhaps believing that was really what had happened with Jesus. His last words were, "'Tis well." Self-sufficient as always, his last act was to feel his own pulse at the moment he expired. Chapter 5. The Collaborators. As a result of Washington's Olympian status, the infant American Republic had managed to avoid a contested presidential election prior to 1796. Exactly how such an event should proceed without tearing the country apart was still very much a matter of speculation and improvisation. Although some semblance of the routinized mechanisms for political parties had begun to congeal during the debate over Jay's treaty, nothing remotely resembling the organized campaign structure of modern political parties yet existed. The method of choosing electors to that odd inspiration called the Electoral College varied from state to state, and the very notion that a candidate should openly solicit votes violated the principled presumption that such behavior itself represented a confession of unworthiness for national office. While a clear political distinction between Federalists and Republicans had emerged during Washington's second term, and fervent editorialists were blazing away as partisans from both sides in the popular press, party labels and issue-oriented platforms were less important than a prospective candidate's revolutionary credentials. Memories of the spirit of 76 were still warm 20 years later, and the chief qualification for the presidency remained a matter of one's historic role in the creation of American independence between 1776 and 1789. Only those leaders who had stepped forward at the national level to promote the great cause when its success was still perilous and problematic were eligible. An exhaustive list of prospects would have included between 20 and 30 names, with Samuel Adams, Alexander Hamilton, Patrick Henry, and James Madison enjoying spirited support. But the four names topping everyone's list would have been almost unanimous: George Washington, Benjamin Franklin, John Adams, and Thomas Jefferson. By 1796, of course, Washington had done his duty. Franklin was dead and gone. That left Adams and Jefferson as the obvious options, and by the spring of 1796 it had become a foregone conclusion that the choice was between them. They were an incongruous pair, but everyone seemed to argue that history had made them into a pair. The incongruities leapt out for all to see. Adams, the short, stout, candid to a fault New Englander, Jefferson, the tall, slender, elegantly elusive Virginian. Adams, the highly combustible, ever-combative, mile-a-minute talker whose favorite form of conversation was an argument. Jefferson, the always cool and self-contained enigma who regarded debate and argument as violations of the natural harmonies he heard inside his own head. The list could go on. The Yankee and the Cavalier, the orator and the writer, the bulldog and the greyhound. They were the odd couple of the American Revolution. And it was the revolution that had brought them together. They had worked side by side in the Continental Congress, first as staunch opponents of reconciliation with England, then as members of the committee to draft the Declaration of Independence. In 1784, they were reunited in Paris, where Jefferson became an unofficial member of the Adams family, and, as Abigail Adams put it, the only person with whom my companion could associate with perfect freedom and reserve. The following year, Jefferson visited Adams for several weeks in London, where, as America's two chief ministers in Europe, they endured the humiliation together when George III ostentatiously turned his back on them during a formal ceremony at court. Adams never forgot this scene, nor did he forget the friend who was standing beside him when it happened. There were, to be sure, important political and ideological differences between the two men, differences that became the basis for the opposing sides they took in the party wars of the 1790s. But as soulmates who had lived together through some of the most formative events of the Revolutionary era and of their own lives, Adams and Jefferson bonded at a personal and emotional level that defied their merely philosophical differences. They were charter members of the Band of Brothers, who had shared the agonies and ecstasies of 1776 as colleagues. No subsequent disagreement could shake this elemental affinity. They knew, trusted, even loved each other for reasons that required no explanation. The two major contestants for the presidency in 1796, then, not only possessed impeccable revolutionary credentials, they had also earned their fame as a team. Within the revolutionary generation, several competing examples of fortuitous cooperation and collaboration had helped to make history happen. Washington and Hamilton during the war, and then again during Washington's second term. Hamilton and Madison on the Federalist Papers. Madison and Jefferson in orchestrating the Republican opposition to Hamilton's financial program and then Jay's Treaty. But in part because it seemed so seminal and symbolic of sectional cooperation, the Adams-Jefferson tandem stood out as the greatest collaboration of them all. Choosing between them seemed like choosing between the head and the heart of the American Revolution. If revolutionary credentials were the major criteria, Adams was virtually unbeatable. His career, indeed his entire life, was made by the American Revolution, and he, in turn, had made American independence his life's project. Perhaps Franklin and Hamilton could claim to have come from further back in the pack, but Adams was another one of those American characters who would have languished in obscurity if born in England or Europe. Instead, he was born in Braintree, 12 miles south of Boston, in 1735, the son of a farmer and shoemaker who sent Adams to Harvard in the hope he might become a minister. For a decade after graduating from college, he probed his soul for signs of a divine calling while earning his keep as a country schoolteacher and then apprentice lawyer. In the mid-1760s, two crucial events determined his fate. First, in 1764, he married Abigail Smith and created with her a partnership of remarkable equity and intimacy. Second, in 1765, he stepped forward to help lead the opposition against the Stamp Act and eventually against every aspect of British policy toward the American colonies. American independence became his ministerial calling, a mission he pursued with all the compressed energy of a latter-day Puritan pastor whose congregation was the American people. Bedeviled by doubts about himself, but never about his cause, Adams and his cousin Samuel had become the most conspicuous opponents of British authority in New England by the time the Continental Congress convened in 1774. In the debates within the Continental Congress, John Adams gained fame as the Atlas of Independence for renouncing any reconciliation with England and for his pamphlet Thoughts on Government, which became the guidebook for several state constitutions. While other delegates in the Congress kept searching for ways to avoid a break with England, Adams insisted the revolution had already begun. He successfully lobbied for Washington to head the Continental Army and personally selected Jefferson to draft the Declaration of Independence, two strategic decisions designed to assure Virginia's support for the cause. For over a year, he served as chair of the Board of War and Ordnance, playing the role of Secretary of War during the most tense and uncertain phase of the fighting. In 1777, the Congress chose him to join Franklin in Paris to negotiate the alliance with France. He returned home for a few months in 1779, just long enough to draft almost single-handedly the Massachusetts Constitution. Then it was back to Paris to work on the peace treaty ending the war, an experience that generated his lifelong enmity toward Franklin, who found him insufferably austere and obsessively diligent. Adams thought Franklin naive about French motives, which were anti-English but not pro-American, and besotted with his own inflated reputation as the ultimate American in Paris. Until 1788, he remained in Europe, first working with Jefferson for legal recognition of the new American nation, as well as for loans from Dutch bankers in Amsterdam, then as America's first minister to the court of St. James in London, where he confirmed his everlasting conviction that England cares no more for us than for the Seminole Indians. His absence from the Constitutional Convention was regretted by all. Along with Madison, he was regarded as America's most sophisticated student of government. He used his spare time in London to toss off three volumes of political philosophy entitled Defense of the Constitution of the United States, which emphasized the advantages of a strong executive, a bicameral legislature, and the principle of checks and balances. He returned to America in time to be elected the first vice president of the United States, which most observers, including Adams himself, interpreted as a popular mandate on his historical contribution to independence. In the American pantheon, with Franklin on his deathbed, he ranked second only to Washington himself. His reputation then fell victim to two nearly calamitous setbacks, one beyond his control and the other the product of his personal flair for perversity. On the former score, Adams had the misfortune to become the first occupant of what he described as the most insignificant office that ever the invention of man contrived or his imagination conceived. Subsequent occupants of the vice presidential office have lengthened the list of semi-humorous complaints about inhabiting a prestigious political prison. For example, not worth a bucket full of spit. But Adams originated the jokes because he was the first prominent American statesman to experience the paradox of being a proverbial heartbeat away from maximum power while languishing in the political version of a cul-de-sac. According to the Constitution, the Vice President had two duties: to remain available if the President died, fell ill, or was removed from office, and to serve as President pro tem of the Senate, casting a vote only to break a tie. During his 8 years in office, Adams cast more tie-breaking votes, at least 31, and perhaps as many as 38, than any subsequent vice president in American history, in part because the small size of the Senate made ties more frequent. But after Adams's initial fling at participating in the debates, the members of the Senate decided that the vice president was not permitted to speak. "It is, to be sure, a punishment to hear other men talk 5 hours every day," Adams wrote to Abigail, "and not be at liberty to talk at all myself, especially as more than half I hear appears to me very young, inconsiderate, and inexperienced." It was a monumental irony. The man famous as the indefatigable orator of independence in the Continental Congress was obliged to remain silent in the legislative councils of the new government. "My office," Adams complained, "is too great a restraint upon such a son of liberty." The great volcano of American political debate was required to confine himself to purely private eruptions. These occurred sporadically in his personal correspondence with Abigail, who remained ensconced at home in Quincy, Massachusetts, and with old revolutionary comrades like Benjamin Rush. Adams deeply resented being marooned and muted in the Senate, like an old warhorse with several charges left in him, now put out to pasture, while crucial battles about the direction of the Republic raged around him. And Adams being Adams, his bitterness found colorful and painfully self-defeating expression in his tirades about the injustice of it all. "The history of our revolution will be one continued lie from one end to the other," he wrote Rush in 1790. "The essence of the whole will be that Dr. Franklin's electric rod smote the earth and out sprang General Washington, that Franklin electrified him with his rod, and thenceforward these two conducted all the policy, negotiations, legislatures, and war." As Adams saw it, he had been prepared by both experience and training to perform a central role in the unfolding drama of winning and securing the American Revolution. Instead, he was relegated to the sidelines as a marginal player, while Johnny-come-latelys like Hamilton and Madison occupied center stage. To make matters worse, his duties in the Senate removed him from the deliberations of the cabinet. Washington seldom consulted him on policy questions, apparently believing that the vice presidency was a legislative office based in the Senate. Therefore, to include Adams in executive decisions violated the constitutional doctrine of separation of powers. When asked by friends about his isolation from the presidential councils, Adams half-heartedly endorsed the same constitutional explanation. "The executive authority is so wholly out of my sphere," he observed, "and it is so delicate a thing for me to meddle in that I avoid it as much as possible." He desperately wanted to be consulted, but he was too proud to push himself forward. He steadfastly supported all the major initiatives of the Washington administration, including Hamilton's financial plan, the suppression of the Whiskey Rebellion, the proclamation of neutrality, and Jay's Treaty, though he had almost no influence on their formulation, and some private reservations about Hamilton's ties with bankers and speculators. It was difficult to think of the ever-combative, highly combustible champion of the American Revolution as extraneous and invisible, but that is what the vice presidency had made him. Adams deserved an assist for making himself into a marginal figure because of remarks he made during the first session of the Senate before it was decided that the vice president could not participate in debates. The issue concerned a minor matter of etiquette. How should the president be addressed by members of Congress? While hardly an earth-shaking question, it had symbolic significance because of the obsessive American suspicion of monarchy, which haunted all conversations about the powers of the presidency under the recently ratified Constitution. Anyone who favored a strong executive was vulnerable to the charge of being a quasi-monarchist and therefore a traitor to the Republican principles of the American Revolution. Adams was so confident in his own revolutionary credentials that he regarded himself as immune to such charges. But when he lectured the Senate on the need for elaborate trappings of authority and proposed that President Washington be addressed as His Majesty or His Highness, his remarks became the butt of several barbed jokes, including the suggestion that he had been seized by nobilimania during his long sojourn in England and might prefer to be addressed as His Rotundity or the Duke of Braintree. Jefferson threw up his hands at the sheer stupidity of Adams's proposals, calling them the most superlatively ridiculous thing I ever heard of. Adams tried to laugh himself out of the monarchical morass, claiming that he simply wanted to assure that the executive branch of the government enjoyed a fighting chance against the awesome powers of the legislature. "The little fishes will eat up the great one," he joked, "unless the great one should devour all the little ones." If all formal titles were to be stigmatized, he wrote to Benjamin Rush, then perhaps Rush's children should start addressing their father as Ben. Mostly, however, Adams stewed and simmered and tried to defend himself. Ever the political pugilist who felt obliged to answer every bell, Adams refused to back away from his belief that the new American government needed a strong executive presence. In a series of 31 essays printed in the Gazette of the United States and subsequently published as Discourses on Davila, he argued that all stable governments required what he called a monarchical principle, meaning a singular figure empowered to embody the will of the nation and to protect the ordinary citizenry from the inevitable accumulation of power by the more wealthy and well-born. In most European states,